On my way to the studio, I passed a woman with a bust line as ample as mine and yours, and her t-shirt read, "Proud to be petite."
I love it.
And
I love it.
And I found that so thematically resonant with the thing that's on my mind, which is about misunderstandings. Because I want to devote this episode to guys, you know, since no one ever devotes anything ever to men.
They're so neglected.
Poor dears.
And misunderstood.
And misunderstanding is how I wish to see the bad boys of fiction who are enjoying a renaissance like no other in Indian pop culture, thanks to a movie that I think you were one of only two people to actually review in the fullness of its awfulness.
In its awfulness, yes.
Which is Animal.
But before we talk about Animal... Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Lit Vickers. We have gone off on a tangent before welcoming you to our podcast.
Wait, but I thought our podcast was called Proud to be Petite.
The next podcast.
That's right.
The side project.
Watch out for our side project. Welcome to The Lit Vickers. You just heard the dulcet tones of my beautiful friend, Deepanjana. And I am Supriya. And I was possibly among the last people in India to watch Animal in the theatres. I was dragged there kicking and screaming against my will, and I disliked it.
And then you kicked and screamed through the film as well.
Yes. The great thing about watching movies in Getty Galaxy is that you're allowed to do that.
Yes, yes.
But of course, you were one of the first people to watch the film.
And unfortunately. I mean, I didn't have a choice in the matter.
Right.
The day job required me to watch it.
That's right.
I was horrified by the film at many levels. Initially, I was actually, I think I had Stockholm Syndrome kind of laughter because I couldn't believe I was watching what I was watching. Yeah, it's an awful film, but I think like when you pointed out that the central character, the protagonist, if one can call him that, of Animal is a Byronic hero, you sent me this as a message and I genuinely, I burst out laughing because I don't think anyone associated even with that film has conceived of the word Byronic in their dreams or nightmares. It's way too intelligent for a film as stupid as Animal.
Although to be fair, I think the term Byronic emerged in a moment in which, you know, some animal-like hypocrisies were floating around. The term emerged, of course, after Lord Byron, who was a poet of great talent and a guy of kind of middling character.
Very hot. But, I mean, it's worth keeping in mind that Byronic was coined by Macaulay, right?
Yes, later.
Yeah.
And kind of based on the disinformation cottage industry around Byron, who did do a lot of the cool, heroic, dashing things that he was supposed to have done, but also just kind of did them really badly.
And was a bit of a failure. And was described by his lover, whom he subsequently abandoned, but one of his lovers, as mad, bad, and dangerous to know.
Which is the basis of the myth of Byron,
yes.
Right? It's not easy to... Sorry to go into seminar mode for those of you who are washing your dishes. It's not always easy to separate the Byronic hero from his cousins, the misunderstood man, the poor little rich boy.
The wounded masculinity, and, right?
Yeah, and the man with the secret sadness within him. I think what really distinguishes these men is our response to them. And in that sense, they're very much... You know, over the last, what, 2.5 centuries of the Byronic myth, maybe less, who keeps track of time anymore?
I can't at any rate.
That's right. So, you know, as I'm saying in the year of our Lord 1997, really, this is a type that is distinguished by its effect on its reader or viewer. And, you know, isn't so much a clear-cut figure of classical proportions himself.
Yeah, and I think as a literary device, like you were saying, Byron had a proper cottage industry of disinformation surrounding his legacy. There was a certain amount that was very deliberately censored, like his bisexuality, for instance. But there was a lot of mythologizing that was also done, which had a sort of lasting effect in terms of informing what we think is virile in a dangerous way.
And noble.
Yeah.
Because it breaks the bounds of convention.
Exactly. more than unconventional, we're talking about anti-convention, actually. Masculinity that is somehow upholding these traditional values, but while being anti-social norms.
That's right. And while I don't want to linger too much on a film, because this is not Proud to be Petite, our film podcast about very long films, but The Lit Pickers, I do want to say that anecdotally, I feel like the people who have praised Animal to me, or the young men who've praised Animal to me, really did respond to that sense that they had, after a long time, a hero who really broke convention in service of some higher truth or some deeper, more profound emotion than they had access to before.
And that higher truth and deeper emotion is just self-love and an acknowledgement of my wounds as a man. You know, the thing about the director of this film is that...
Sandeep Reddy Vanga.
Yes, is that he's really got a pulse on this victim complex that
has swamped our country in the last decade or so.
And very much informs a lot of the youth, particularly the male youth. They're able to put blame on that sense of woundedness because it is because of that that they are doing something bad. It is because of that they're doing something, they're not able to get the things that they want. You know, like it's become a justification.
That's right.
And for better or for worse, and in this case, very much for the worse, Sandeep Reddy Vanga is able to depict that in a way that resonates with audiences.
Yeah, and I feel like this meta narrative around the film, which is of people like you and I not really having much time for this kind of depiction, also harks back to a feature of the bad boy TM, which is... You know, and there's the Oscar Wilde character who says women are meant to be loved, not understood, which is supposed to be funny and ironic, but I feel like it's an irony that really gets at the symptoms of masculinity and femininity, because it is men who have the privilege of being both loved and understood. Mm. Women can never be both. And men demand love through understanding, because to be understood means to be forgiven. Mm. And that's kind of the path, I think, that the emotional journey, I think, that... Animal and cultural products like it want to take us on.
Something I find very interesting about the Byronic hero is that, because we should keep in mind the novels that have featured Byronic heroes as the object of their attention and desire, were the first of the mass entertainments in the modern world.
You're talking about the Gothic novels.
I'm talking about the Gothic novels.
Of late 18th and 19th century England.
Yeah. These were not the literary fiction that many of them are considered today. They were...
Trash.
Trash, exactly. They were popular. They were populist. And in that context, the Byronic hero sometimes, not always, obviously not always, but sometimes the Byronic hero was necessary to make space for modernity. And modernity is something that will really push the boundaries and push society towards accepting aspects that are considered new, that are considered fringe, that the establishment and the elite would rather blinker themselves to. And for me, a great example of that is Heathcliff. Obviously, he's the most obvious of Byronic heroes. But, you know, the fact that he's darker, the fact that he goes out and travels the world and comes back rich.
Apologies for, you know, the ghastly usage, but isn't he, quote unquote, half gypsy in the book?
Yeah, he's supposed to have some sort of gypsy blood. And gypsy is, of course, a term that in that time, as well as now, was a marginalized community, not pure blood.
Right.
Dirty, like, you know, these connotations of...
The wandering, thieving other.
Just the nomadic awfulness of...
The usurper.
Yeah, exactly. The criminal, all that darkness. And so Heathcliff sort of brings that to the center just by his presence. And he defies those things as well by not behaving according to that norm. He's still a bad guy because of all of this sort of association around him, and also because of what he leaves the woman in love with him, what he leaves her as, you know.
Dead.
Dead is the spoiler. Oops.
Sorry.
But he's also...
But not as sorry as Kathy.
Oh my God. At this point of time, I've just got Kate Bush in my head as well. But anyway, the thing is that he comes to the center, though, in a way that someone like him in reality would really have struggled to. Mm. So the Byronic hero in some cases like this actually opens up the space. Faust is another great example, a very classic Byronic hero who nevertheless opens up a space for conversation, of pushing certain boundaries.
That's right. You know, by making a deal with the devil in a superficially arch-religious society,
yes,
you are trying to express that truth can lie beyond the boundaries of convention, and that it will bring you to tears, and that it demands enormous, sometimes terminal sacrifice.
And that...
But you can't not talk about it.
And also that just by not voicing this in as many words, but like the intellect is favored more by the devil than the religious setup. Faust's demand for the kind of freedom that he wants, both of his desires, but his desires are intellectual as they are bodily. There isn't space within conventional society for this, for the intellect to thrive. And this is an old thing. Eve's apple, bite of knowledge, understanding good and evil.
And in that sense, you can see why, you know, the bad boy who is the Byronic hero being misunderstood is kind of rooted in some truth.
Yeah.
You know, if you're making an argument for forbidden knowledge, then you have to accept that.
It's just that I don't think that's been true in the 20th century onwards.
Oh, absolutely not.
You know, like by the time we come to modern literature, the Byronic hero is just an excuse for awful, obnoxious characters being grandiose, being presented as grand and sexy and just, you know, anti-heroes.
I wonder what it means to be an anti-hero in a time when all kinds of intellectual and cultural capital are available to a certain section of the reading and writing public than ever before. There is the subaltern hero, but I don't think we're talking about the same thing at all when we're talking about that.
No.
The subaltern hero, again, to stick to popular Indian cinema, is Zabia in Fandry, right?
Yep.
But he's not...
he's not Byronic.
He's not what's-his-name in Animal.
Oh, let's just leave him as what's-his-name. He's not the animal in Animal.
He's not the animal in Animal.
Yeah, it's also because as we come into the 20th century, maybe because of what you're talking about, because the subaltern hero sort of really develops an identity and a set of politics that are very sort of specific to the subaltern context, the Byronic hero becomes more and more elite.
That's absolutely right. And in fact, he kind of passes through a filter. You know, in the end, I feel like the echoes of the Byronic hero are in the last Byronic hero is maybe Batman. And that's not even Batman to start out with, who's kind of like a happy-go-lucky, you know, toot toot, beep beep kind of cartoon character. But like once they recognize that he's kind of a terrorist, and then he becomes the glowering misunderstood.
Yeah, in literature, I was thinking about this just the other day. Florentino Ariza of Love in the Time of Cholera.
Beautiful book.
Beautiful book, which, you know, I fell in love with the book and the writing. But Florentino is a disaster of masculinity, humanity, you name it. It is bad. He's awful. Like, literally, his only redeeming feature is also corrupted, which is that, you know, he's in love with
his
Fermina.
His great love.
Yeah. But even that is expressed in such toxic terms. I'm not even talking about the 622 women that he slept with or the 14-year-old that he has sex with, not even including any of that. It's how he is with Fermina for so much of the novel. It isn't until he's much older that his behavior towards her becomes somewhat more acceptable, and, you know, that ending is always going to have my heart. However, he's exactly the kind of man that you would never want anywhere around you, but who becomes incredibly sexy because of the way he's written.
I think there is a strain of great, even genius writing from outside the metropoles of empire that are just like giant apologia for men. And I think Marquez is at the top of that game. You know, he defined it. No Malayali man can conceive of himself except through the lens of Marquez.
I think Bengalis as well. I think anyone who's read Marquez is like, yes, you speak for me.
You speak for me, the real subaltern hero.
Yeah, yeah. Except you're not subaltern at all. You're right on top of the pile and you're dominating whatever you can. Is there a Byronic hero that you found yourself unwittingly loving?
While I was on my way here to this recording, I was trying to think of Byronic heroes I feel warmly towards. And then I got distracted by Proud to be Petite.
Which is the best distraction? A singular bust line to take your attention away from the wounded masculinity? I love the symbolism here.
Thank you. And it led me to regretfully conclude that this is not the case. Part of this, of course, is just about my mental makeup. That I have always liked the goody-two-shoes, men who do their best type of characters. I might as well confess that, you know, in Anna Karenina, a book in which Tolstoy clearly hates everyone he is writing about, the reader's sympathy naturally gravitates towards Anna because she is the heroine and she is the most fully realized character. Hmm. She has a bad boy who is Kronsky, who's like a kind of blonde jockey soldier kind of guy. And the husband who actually comes off very badly in Tolstoy because he's so obscenely dutiful and mannered and trapped in form. I have to say, I had to like put the novel down halfway and be like, do I like this guy? Because among other things, I feel like Tolstoy probably meant for him to be like devastatingly crumbly, you know? In direct contrast, of course, to Vronsky, who's supposed to give us the impression of like a marble statue or whatever.
Right. Blech.
Sorry, that was a vomit sound. You know, I have the vague memory that I think Jude Law played Karenin in maybe the Joe Wright adaptation.
Oh,
and if I'm right, I'm like, oh, Joe Wright had the same idea as me. Maybe I think because I'm fatally attracted to the dutiful man, it's very difficult for me to feel sympathy for the beautiful man.
Yeah,
but I'm.
That's good. That's very good. I do think that's quite fascinating because, you know, this notion of the upholder of virtue or the paragon of virtue, the male paragon of virtue, really, that's rarely been considered a heroic quality for men. You know, when you look at how heroes have been depicted across cycles of stories, very rarely is just a pure and simple good guy considered narrative worthy.
At least not after the dawn of modernity, right? Mm. When even very early on, like in the time of Chaucer, you have a kind of mocking attitude towards
exactly.
the chivalrous man.
Yeah.
And even I understand where that comes from, because in a feudal society, very few people can afford to be chivalrous.
That's true. But even if you're looking at, and I'm sticking to English here mostly, but, you know, the knights, for instance, by no means are they just flat good. The knights are very complicated characters just for the violence that they inflict.
They struggle.
They struggle, you know, their challenges are as much emotional as they are physical. The flawed knight, there is in fact only a flawed knight. I can't think of a perfect knight.
Who doesn't immediately
die.
Yeah, you know? Get squeezed out of the story.
Just out. And of course, if you go even further back to the myth cycles, then of course it gets a lot more murky. But even there, like if a hero starts off as good, he will very quickly have to do things that are morally ambiguous to make him worthy of being a hero in the story.
Right. I think the difference between the pre-modern hero and the modern hero is that when the final boss is God or the gods, there's no escaping it. Mm. You know, then it doesn't matter how misunderstood you are or how beloved you are or whatever. Your fate is the one thing you will never be able to defeat, and everything you do kind of becomes fraught with beauty and fragility in that context.
What's very interesting to me is that the 20th century, the late 20th century particularly, really opens up the space for female Byronic heroes as well. And I'm thinking of someone like Mrs. Coulter in Philip Pullman's Dark Materials books. Mm. She's not quite a villainess in the standard sense of the term.
No, but you're so right. We start off thinking of her as a villain. And we have kind of the opposite journey with
Asriel.
Yes, thank you. Because we think that this might be someone who's on our side. Yeah. And then we realize
he reveals
the truth
himself
is much more complicated.
To be much more monstrous.
Yeah.
The redemption arc for Mrs. Coulter is actually quite beautifully plotted through the trilogy. But, you know, the thing is that even when she ultimately does the good things...
Yes, spoiler.
Again. There's a whole TV series also, I think, now on it. But anyway, even when she finally sort of does the good things and sort of restores some amount of reader sympathy for herself by being motherly, you know, maternal towards Lyra, even then you're not allowed to forget, which is why she's a Byronic hero for me. You're not allowed to forget all the things that make her so angular and difficult and evil in parts.
Yeah, I think the introduction of female subjectivity into modern literature really changed the game forever and is the reason why you and I are here doing Proud to be Petite. I think of some of the Hindi novels that I've read in translation recently by writers like Mridula Garg and Usha Priyamvada. And I'm struck by a quality that I think modern women writers bring to their work on anti-heroines, which is that they don't expect you to sympathize with them. Perhaps they do expect you to understand them, and they care that you engage with them and you think about them, and perhaps they want them to be unforgettable. But that sense of self-pitying victimhood just doesn't exist over there. We can't afford to do that as women. I don't think anyone can afford to proclaim victimhood in the way that powerful men can, because they're the only ones who will never be victims.
And it's that distinction that you just made, right, between understanding and sympathizing. That's something that I feel has been the first thing that women characters and women writers, in that sense, have emphasized when they're sort of, you know, trying to get something from the reader, or trying to get an emotional response from the reader. That's the distinction that male Byronic heroes do not care for.
That's right. In some cases, not all cases, but definitely when I'm thinking of these modern Hindi writers, it feels like they've made a stand and a choice, as if speaking to the Oscar Wilde epigram, which is that, you know, we'd rather be understood than loved.
Exactly. And because understanding requires you to think of context, it requires you to think of social structures, which is what a lot of these sort of angularities are responding to, even created by. It's like a serrated edge that has been created by experience of going up against a structure or being treated a particular way by a structure and how you respond to it. So yeah, that's always quite interesting to me, because in terms of how men have been written, that just does not happen. No man wants to bring that distinction in. No man wants to risk losing the sympathy vote.
That's exactly right.
I mean, there you have it. That was the 20th century masculinity in a nutshell. We'll be done. We'll come back to you next week. That's all I had to say. Yeah. So that was the Lit Pickers. This is Dipanjana. I'm with Supriya. We'll be back soon with better men and great women. And we are still proud to be petite.
See you, size XS.
And XL. And XXL.
Bye for now. You were listening to the Lit Pickers. Oh, you already said that.
I love it. We had no intro, but we have two outros.
The Lit Pickers is a Made in India production. Don't forget to rate and review and follow or subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. Also, tell everyone you know about the show. Share it on social media, tell your friends and family, scream about it on your rooftop. It really helps get the word out. Oh, and use the hashtag LitPickers. Follow Supriya and Dipanjana on Twitter or Instagram. You can also find all of the books they've mentioned or recommended in an online resource via a link in our episode description. Thanks. Keep listening.